Accession number 30249, Reel 15.
And farmers, and school teachers, and you know, all sorts of lovely, lovely people. And they were, some of these people were really lovely. And just, well, like ordinary people the world over, they just wanted to be left alone. They just want to get on with their lives, you know. Just want to live, for God's sake, you know, and put food on the table. And it's awful to see it on the news now. You know, the place being just ripped to pieces, you know.
Yes, I imagine having been there, and knowing the people, it must be upsetting for you.
Yeah, it doesn't plough my mind too much, but it does, it upsets me to think. I mean, it looked as then when I went that there was this window there that where maybe, just maybe, we could have got it sorted out, you know. Maybe it was a big maybe even then, really, you know. And I suppose you mentioned the Americans earlier, and the Americans really reared their ugly heads in Iraq for me, because they were everywhere. I mean, America's running the place, you know, from top to bottom, really. I know there's the British sector, etc., but I think ultimately the Americans were calling the shots. And you had huge American convoys travelling north to south, convoys with armoured vehicles and road mending, road graders and things, and vast convoys of petrol tankers and things like that, with armoured vehicles protecting them, and all travelling at high speed, and the Americans all heavily, heavily armed, helmeted, black goggles, face masks quite often. Really intimidating stuff. I mean, I was in a street patrol in one place in uniform, because I was in Dutch Marine uniform on this trip, so that I merged with my friends, you know. And I had an American point, an M16 at me at one stage. And because they were panicking. We were doing a walking a street patrol, and a convoy came through this town in a great hurry, because they don't want to stop anywhere in case they're ambushed, you know. And they'd got held up at a roundabout. There was a broken down vehicle on a roundabout, and this convoy had come to a grinding halt in the middle of this built up area. And the Americans are up on their vehicles and in the road, weapons up, picking targets all the time. And I, for a few seconds, I was one of the targets, and I was Dutch. I was, you know, in Dutch uniform, which is virtually identical to American uniform. And I just hollered at this guy something very unpleasant, and he just moved his weapon and you know, put his sights on somebody else. But they didn't endear themselves to me at all. They behave very badly in my book. They're obviously, I mean, they have good cause to be frightened, especially now. But they behave frightened, you know, and as a consequence, they become more and more aggressive. There are some real horror stories about what Americans have been up to over there, you know. Well, their behaviour in Afghanistan has been quite appalling at times. I know that's war, and atrocities are committed by all sides, you know, but I just feel the Americans have done their fair share, to be honest. So I Yeah, that I was sick of Americans by the end of that trip. I mean, I didn't have that much to do with them, but what I did see of them, I just thought I really need to keep well away from these people, you know. Because they truly do shoot first and ask questions afterwards, so... But I guess that trip probably that ended without mishap.
Were you there?
I was there 2 weeks, and it was the first time that I had air-conditioned accommodation, apart from being in a hospital. But and the Dutch had their base had air-conditioned, like little porter cabin units, and I had one of those to live in all on my own. I mean, I usually end up hunkering down with umpteen other smelly people, you know. But I had a camp bed and air conditioning and blinds at the window, which was absolute luxury, and a shower just down the, you know, not far away. That was real luxury. It made life more than bearable, and very good food. But again, if you live in a fort, then they've got the opportunity, they've got the security to provide you with some decent sort of living.
Is that what they're in, a fort? Mm.
Yes.
A multinational
standard. No, this was a Dutch fort, and it's the standard fort. We throw up a dirt wall all the way around, you know, they dig a ditch and use the earth to make a wall, just like the Romans did, and they put watchtowers on the corners and have a gate with watchtowers. Nothing's changed in a couple of thousand years, you know. So you live inside this fairly secure area. You know.
And were most of the troops, from what you could see, doing that, you know, living in these places?
Yeah.
I suppose the Americans had something rather more.
I don't know what the Americans had down there. They would have... yeah, I mean, the Americans would probably throw up concrete walls and, you know, very high walls. And once they're established, they're going to build... You know, wherever they go, they build to stay. So you get a lot of concrete used and things, you know. But I mean, most of the places, the forts I stay in, are either dirt banks, you know, or occasionally you get concrete barriers built round or something, you know. But it's usually fairly basic stuff, you know. But the Americans, once they move in, they build towns, and, you know. Heifer keeps. So.
Did you see any McDonald's?
I asked. I'm a great one for wreckage, painting wreckage. And I said, show me some. I want to see some wreckage. I want to see some wrecked aeroplanes and some wrecked tanks. And so the Dutch arranged for me to go to Talil Air Base, which is near Nasiriyah. So we drove off down to Talil. And Talil Air Base, I think it was Saddam's main air base, Talil, and it had something like 10,000 Americans living there in this one place. And that was a massive, massive area. I mean, they'd taken over Saddam's main sort of air base and built on it, basically. But I mean, they had the Dutch boys said, "Oh, we'll go there because we get good food there. Oh, we'll go there for the day." And we went into their I can't call it a canteen; it was a restaurant. And at that stage, it only sat 5,000 people at that stage, and they were going to double the size of it. But we went in there, and you could have eaten. For 20 years, you know. I mean, the food in this place was just amazing. I mean, it you know, they always talk about apple pie and ice cream, but it's true. You know, there you are in this scorching hot desert, you know, in this sort of fly-blown country, and there you are, you know, with burgers and peppered steak and gammon and salads and you name it, it was there, you know, and ice cream and blancmange, whatever you wanted, it was there. Having sort of had like 10 days eating, well, still eating nice stuff, but Dutch food, which is quite plain, you know, and you go into a place like that, and I was totally bemused, you know, I thought, I don't know what to eat, you know, I panicked, you know, what do I choose, you know. But that's why you get lots of fat American servicemen, because they're putting in more than they're taking out, I think, most of the time. But that was quite an interesting place, and it was full of wreckage again, and there were lots of T-55 tanks lying around, and a lot of wrecked Iraqi aeroplanes. Most of them seem to be either of French origin or Russian origin, because of course the good old French again were selling stuff to Saddam right up to the bitter end, of course.
So were you doing paintings of the wreckage?
Yeah.
Photography?
Yeah, I did a few sketches and lots of photographs of various bits and pieces. I mean, this wreckage ends up, you know, it looks like sculpture, you know, I view it as sculpture more than wreckage, really. So, lovely. I would just fascinate. I could spend hours in breakers' yards and places like that, you know. Looking at
them. I imagine shapes a lot.
Yes.
Even the colours, aren't
they?
Yeah,
the colours are super, yeah. Especially aeroplanes that have been wrecked and they're burnt, and all these rich, lovely, rich colours and bits of aluminium showing through and things, you know. Spectacular to look at. Great, again, lovely, lovely subjects for painters, you know. So, well, this airbase also, it took in within its perimeter. Was the city of Ur. And one of the Dutch guys just said, let's go and look at Ur, you know. So we hopped in the Land Rover and drove for a couple of miles, and there we are, you know, in this sort of mud-built city. And there was a pyramid there that Saddam had restored. He'd actually restored this sort of, put all the mud brick back, you know. So we climbed to the top of this pyramid, and then we wandered around, and you could see the sort of partially excavated foundations of buildings and things, you know. I mean, that was, again, was just an incredible contrast again, you know. You go from, in the space of 24 hours, you go from the real ghastly bits to things, and you think, wow, you know, what am I doing here? How did I get here? You know,
was that being respected by the Americans? The ruins.
Yes, it was. Yeah, I mean, they were. There were groups of Americans wandering around looking, so that they appreciated what was there. It wasn't being guarded, as far as I could tell, or anything like that. But it wasn't. You know, it wasn't being driven over or built on or anything like that. They left it well alone, you know. And it was one of the sites that Saddam had looked after. He realised the value of some of these places, you know. So that was quite a highlight, really, you know. So I seem to have got a habit of seeing these archaeological sort of ruins, you know, as you travel around, you know. I can't think of much else to tell you about that trip. Again, it was quite straightforward. It was pretty tough, on the move all the time. I suppose one of the problems always with these trips that I do is that you're on the move a lot. You only have a limited number of days, and you always have a lot to pack in.
You were saying earlier that the army wants you in and out. police things.
Yeah.
So you explained that so well earlier, Gordon.
Yeah, I mean, you're a pain in the side, really, aren't you? You know, they can do without visitors, to be honest.
What you've been describing, you know, the various equipment, you know, the planes that you've been flown in on your various trips, and this that was laid on for you.
Yes.
It must be quite costly to the army, really, as well.
Yes, it is, yeah.
Yes.
But sometimes they've got nothing else to do.
Like, you find that they're quite flattered to actually have who's interested in what they're doing.
I don't think I've ever been greeted with anything other than enthusiasm anywhere. As soon as I say, how does that work, or can you show me, do you mind if I, and they say, yeah, right, we'll organise it, you know. And it happens. I never get let down. It always happens, you know. And if a commanding officer says to me, you just tell them what you want, and they'll do it. That's it. You know, like when I said, you know, I want to see wreckage, and they have a little think, and they think, oh, well, we'll phone the Americans. They're only 100 kilometres away. We'll see, you know. And then on this trip, I said, I want to go on a helicopter. You do helicopter patrols? I want to go on a helicopter patrol. You know, it was, well, we haven't got much fuel, and you know, but we'll try. So they phone up and they talk to somebody down the road, and they say, oh yeah, we're like, all right, yeah, well, right, we'll put on a patrol for him, and off we go. What power? I mean, I've a lot more power there than ever I have at home. You know, I mean, you get things done. But then I get the job done, you know. But it's also it's quite tiring in that I'm having to think on my feet all the time, and I'm having to, you know, they drop me into a place. I don't know anybody, and I've said this before, but you don't know anybody. You've got to suss it out really fast. What do these people do? What can I get away with? What are they expecting? What can I give them that they're not expecting that they'll accept? You know, and then you start to talk around it, and then once you've asked them what they're doing, and then very quickly you've got to say, well, what I'd like to do is A, B, C, D, E, and F, from what you've told me, you know. And I'm doing this in the first 10 minutes, really, that I get there, you know. I'm knackered. You know, I'm sort of got jet lag or something, you know. But when they talk about hitting the ground running, you know, but I mean,
did you say had 2 weeks to do all of this,
to get all your ideas in the bag?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because you don't have time to sort of reconsider.
No. Yeah. No. You've got to be, and you've got to cover all your options. You've got to make sure that you've got more than enough. You've got to make sure you've got so much information that you're only going to use 10% of it, you know. So I just come back jam packed full of ideas, you know. Arch, can I read you another bit from my diary? Do you mind?
That's fine. Yes, we've got time.
Right.
Yes.
It's probably it won't be in sequence. Let's just have a little look. Right, this is visiting visiting one of the schools on the Euphrates. He said the whole school of 250 children seemed to be milling around, each one of them wanting their photo taken. So I decide to have the Marines gather them all together for a school photograph. After much shouting and shoving, I manage to get off 2 frames before they all come dashing towards me, each of them wanting to be in the front of my lens. As I'm engulfed, they are whistling at a pitch which literally makes my ears hurt. Wish I could whistle like that. We bid our farewells with sadness on my part, There is just nothing but nothing we can do for them. Only keep them in our thoughts and tell the Western world what is happening here. The drive back to home base is uneventful, apart from passing one dead horse in the road, already bloated, a traffic accident with a large crowd enjoying the spectacle of an injured driver, and several vehicles driving towards us on our one-way carriageway with no lights on in the gathering dusk. Just a normal, quiet drive home.
It's how lovely that you kept a diary.
It's the only way I can,
it's the immediacy of that.
And can I? Would you mind if I read you one more bit?
No, not at all. Oh, right. Most interesting.
This is in the town of Al Qaeda. And this is about, it refers to the first Gulf War. The main bridge over the Euphrates was bombed by the Americans on a Friday, the holy day for Muslims, when it was thronged with families having a day off. 60 were killed just on the bridge. A section of 30 or 40 metres was blown away in an instant. The river is now crossed by a ramshackle pontoon structure for vehicles and an even less stable footway made of twisted rusty girders and plates of iron, the final section of which rears up in front of you as you set foot on it. Our drive through town is the now familiar sense-numbing experience of noise, smells and sights, the donkey carts, caged chicken, decaying buildings, noisy children and refuse of every description. And so it goes on and on. Yes. But those notes are really useful to me when I'm painting, because I can, because I can paint pictures, you know, from the memory that sort of
and
generates.
That was a terrible,
you know,
thing then in the first Gulf War.
Yeah. I mean, that illustrates just how ignorant Americans are, how arrogant they are, probably more than ignorant. You know, to take out bridges full of innocent people, middle of the day, on their holy day, for no reason. I mean, they could have. I can accept them blowing up bridges, but they have the technology to do it in the middle of the night. But now they have to do it when it kills the maximum number of people, you know. Now that's either intentional or it's just because they just. Don't think, not interested, not considerate, not interested in what happens to people. I think it's the latter. I don't think they care, to be honest. And you wouldn't catch us doing that.
End of reel 14. So this is reel 13 and 14 on this reel. Gordon Rushmer. Thank you.